This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Edward Shahada, professor and chair of the LSU Department of Sociology. He's been there for over 20 years, and he has been at the forefront of fighting crime in Baton Rouge and finding out why we've had so much difficulty with violent crime in our area. He's worked closely with the district attorney, Hiller Moore, who was on this show a few days ago. We'll talk with Ed Shahada. Also on the show, we are slated to hear from Karen Carter-Peterson, state senator and chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. 2014 shapes up as a big year as U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu seeks a fourth term against the challenge of Republican Bill Cassidy. We'll talk about it. But first, the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it is 877-217-5757, and you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In studio is Dr. Ed Shahada, professor and chair, LSU Department of Sociology. He's been with the Old War School now for over two decades and has been at the vanguard of assessing crime in this community. And there's been much to assess, has there not?
There has indeed, Jim.
Why do we have a distinct problem here that other communities don't have, at least not in the degree that we do?
Yeah, in 2009, you know, Baton Rouge was the second most violent city in America, and New Orleans being the first, so that makes Baton Rouge and New Orleans the most violent corridor in America. And a lot of people think that it began with Katrina, but actually it began about 2 to 3 years before that. Katrina certainly accelerated the increase in violence, but the rise in violence began about 2002, 2003.
And why was that? What happened then?
We suddenly got a rise in what we call floaters. Now, what are floaters? Floaters are young men of crime-prone age, 16 to 19, who are not connected to anything. They are not in school. They're not in the military. They're not employed. They're not even in the labor force. They're not married. Nothing. They're not connected to anything at all. So essentially, we have no control over them. This term floaters is something that I coined in the literature. So the second question is, why did Baton Rouge all of a sudden get a whole bunch of floaters? And we've investigated this further. I'm still investigating it now. But it turns out 15 years prior to that time, Baton Rouge got a spike in teen fertility. And when you look at teen fertility, when you look at children born to teens, they're vulnerable to poverty, they're vulnerable to abuse, they're vulnerable to neglect. And 15 to 17 years later, they enter the crime-prone age group. So we're really seeing an echo of that period.
So this would be like from, say, 1985 to 87, we had a spike in teen fertility, and that affected the crime, violent crime in particular, around 2002, 2003, and onward.
Exactly, because you think back to that era, that was kind of the bad old days of crime in America with, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic and lots of inner city problems.
Well, it's been a fairly easy target to say that all of our problems, or much of them, are related to Katrina. That's not necessarily the case, is it?
Not necessarily the case. Katrina accelerated the decline. You know, what Katrina did, it blew in a lot of wind and water, but what it also did is blow in our direction a lot of people from New Orleans who were looking for relief, just good people, and Baton Rouge opened its arms. It also drew a much smaller element, a crime-prone element. And so you got what happened after Katrina was the culture of crime began to change. And you began to see after Katrina that crime in Baton Rouge became more vicious. You began to see the running shoes on the telephone wires. You began to see the code of silence. So things did change after Katrina, but Katrina is not the only reason why crime increased in Baton Rouge.
Well, the situation is such that this year the murders have been down, although for a city our size, still way above the national average. But is there progress being made?
Oh, yeah. Huge progress. You know, New York, the murder rate in New York went down 80%, but it took them 20 years. Our murder rate went down 35 or 36%, and in just 1 year. And that's an amazing change.
35 or 36%, mm-hmm. that's in the first half of the year, right?
Right. So year-to-date, we now have 32 actual murders in the city. I know people heard there's more, but some of those are negligent homicides. Some of those are justifiables. But actual criminal homicides, we're at 32 right now. Last year at this time, we were at 50.
What do you attribute this to?
Brave.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a concerted effort, and it's making a big, big difference.
What has Brave done that other endeavors did not?
What Brave is it's a group violence initiative. So we're going after group violence, gangs, and so on. And I'll say at the outset, you know, I read a Time magazine article a while back, and they said that the way they're going to cure cancer, or at least deal with cancer here in the future, there's not going to be any magic pill, any one magic medicine, any one magic MRI. What it's actually going to be is a coalition of medical workers who work together. You've got the expert in MRIs, the radiologist, the expert in treatment, and so on. It's the same thing with Brave. It's a collective effort for the first time. I was a little cynical at first. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, is this just another showpiece? Is this another, you know, what it, you know, something for public consumption? But it's a coalition of people. You've got the DA's office, the mayor's office, the sheriff's office. You've got all these nonprofit groups, the Dream Center, the Hope Ministries, and the rest of them. And, of course, you've got LSU, kind of the, you know, we're the analysts in the background telling the generals, go here, go mm-hmm. there, get this guy, get that guy. And it's all working together. And, so, and it's worked.
Well, you've made this your passion in life. And how can LSU... major university, right in the heart of the city as far as crime being evident, not so far from campus. How can LSU participate and improve and enhance the quality of life?
Well, I think Brave is a great example here. You know, I used to sit quietly at my computer and write academic papers that other academics would read, and, you know, and maybe they read them, maybe they didn't. But there's something uniquely satisfying about this, to take LSU's talent. We've got a great team, and I'll tell you about them, who do all the data and the intelligence work behind this product, and to see a tangible outcome. We've got people that are coming up with lists of people that are causing problems, so we can tell the police. We've got people that do hotspot mapping to say, go here, go there. And, of course, we've got people analyzing gang networks, saying, you know, watch for these ones, watch for the, you know, and so on and so forth, looking mm-hmm. at it at the aggregate level. It's wonderful to be a part of it.
You've worked closely with Hiller Moore, the district attorney, haven't you?
Very closely.
How so?
I think we formed our own little book club right now, just Hiller and I, because he'll call me up and say, have you read uh-huh. this latest book? What else can we do to improve crime, to lower crime in the city? Just recently we talked about this book called The City That Beat Crime. It's a book about what New York did. And so we talk about every single murder. He tells us, all right, can you do some hotspot mapping over here? He calls us up. I mean, it's like a hotline. And he calls us up. We come up with some information for them, and then they act upon it. And we want to even get closer with that.
We're visiting with Ed Shahada, who has been with the LSU Department of Sociology for over 20 years and has studied crime around the country, and in particular in this community, and there is much to study. And as you pointed out, New Orleans and Baton Rouge, perhaps the most dangerous corridor in the United States, but yet few of our public officials ever address this. They'll talk about economic development and education and the environment, but rarely do they talk about crime. Why?
You know, crime is a very stigmatizing behavior. And, you know, people that commit crimes aren't necessarily bad people, but crime is a very unpleasant thing. When you talk about economic development, it's a nice thing. You talk about parks, that's a nice thing. But when we're talking about crime, it's very stigmatizing. It's very negative. And there's a lot of sensitivity. And I understand the political outlines of talking about crime as well. And I face that all my life in my work. And but rather than wrap it in a veil of silence, cloak it in obscurity and so on. We're now dealing with it head on, and it's working.
Hiller Moore was on this show a few days ago and noted that 80% of the victims are African American in Baton Rouge of violent crime. Quite often, black people are portrayed as the perpetrators, but they're also the victims. So what about people who live in these neighborhoods that are hot spots? It must not be an easy thing.
It's not an easy thing for them. You hit it right on the head. I mean, when people talk about crime and they talk about the race dimensions of crime, they're talking about perpetrators. But you got to understand that the victims of crime are overwhelmingly, violent crime, are overwhelmingly African-American. So the benefiters, those who benefit from Brave, are people in the African-American community. Not all African-American communities are beset with crime, but it's the ones that have a lot of poverty in them, and they're the ones that are going to benefit from this the most.
Is there a tendency to say it's not my problem if people live in a neighborhood, and as many mm-hmm. people do in Baton Rouge, that you don't see an African-American for blocks and blocks?
You know, I've heard that. People have even whispered to me sometimes, said, well, what do I care? What do I care if they're killing each other? And I say two things. One, when violence in the city spreads, how do you know that that next bullet at the parade, that next bullet at the mall or at the park is not going to hit your loved one? It's happened. I mean, if you can guarantee me that won't happen, fine. You know, I'll agree with you, but that's not true. Number two, talking about economic development, crime is a cancer. And when you're on the bad list, when Baton Rouge is top five on violent crime, people don't invest in this city. I've had students come to me and say, Professor, I'm glad you put crime in Baton Rouge in context, because my daddy called and said he didn't want his little girl living in Baton Rouge. Now multiply that conversation 1,000 times. How many times does a spouse say to the other, honey, let's not settle the business in Baton Rouge. Business is competitive enough. We don't need crime superimposed on our problems.
Well, the governor has not talked much about crime, if any. It's as though it's something that's not in his realm, but I would think that any public official, especially a governor or a U.S. senator, I don't hear Mary Landrieu and David Vitter talking much about it either. This is an issue that our leaders should be focusing upon.
It's very true, and we'd like to hear more. Having said that, I can say that the local officials, from the mayor to the sheriff to the DA to the ATF to everybody else to all the ministries, to especially the police chief, and I know I've left out a bunch of people, for the first time that I've been here in 20 years, I've seen a tremendous coalition of people coming together. It's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's room for improvement. I'd be happy to talk about that, but it's a very positive sign. At the upper level of leadership, I can't say,
But coming together, you think that works?
Oh, it's just made all the difference in the world. It's made all the difference in the world. And it's what happened in New York. That's how they did it in New York. They got all these groups together, nonprofits. They got the local government. They got the citizens behind them. And they beat this thing back into the ground.
Do we need more people on the streets?
We did this entire thing without hiring a single extra police officer, and we brought it down 35%. Yeah, I'd like to see more police on the streets, and there's other things that we could do as well. There's still things that we can do more, even with the resources that we have.
Hiller Moore commented, and it's been stated on this show a few times, about how victims quite often are afraid.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just had a friend of mine, a neighbor of mine, tell me the other day. He said, you know, my car was stolen, and I found out that the perpetrator had a previous record for this and that and murder and also in robbery. He said, and they asked me to testify. And he said, nope, I'm not going to testify, because if this guy got out for murder, he'll be out after the car theft. I'm too afraid. I can understand people's reticence, but they need to know that it's working. They need to know to come forward, because this can't just be the police.
Mm-hmm. And if bad people do bad things and they're not held accountable, quite often they'll do them again.
They'll do them again. A while back, my son was robbed at gunpoint and hit with a gun. Thank God he's okay.
Where was this?
This was on Highland and Lee, that area around there, which is not a bad area, you know. But things can happen, and he was out too late at night. He's not afraid to prosecute, and neither am I, and we're trying to go after these people.
We'll return with Ed Shahada, professor and chair of the LSU Department of Sociology, back after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. In just a bit, we'll hear from Karen Carter-Peterson, the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party and state senator from the great city of New Orleans. We're visiting with Ed Shahada, the chairman of the LSU Department of Sociology, a criminologist like few others who has studied crime in the United States and in this area. You mentioned Baton Rouge and New Orleans being the most dangerous corridor in America. Are there commonalities between the two cities?
There are. I mean, these are what I would call leading-edge cities, like Baltimore, like Washington, D.C., like Detroit, where we have very high rates of poverty. We have concentrated poverty as well. In other words, it's not just a high rate of poverty, but poverty is concentrated together. You know, it's a nexus of other social problems as well. I'm not sure if this is correct, but I've heard that we're also, Baton Rouge is the city with the highest rates of new AIDS cases and so on. So we have social problems, and these manifest themselves in terms of crime.
HB in Denham Springs. HB, you're on the air with Ed Shahada. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. It's all over the news this morning where a judge in New York City has ordered Mayor Bloomberg, I think, and the police force there to stop the stop and frisk law that they have on the books because it unfairly targets African American and Hispanics. Mayor Bloomberg is going to appeal this, and as you well know, the process may take some time. Do you think that this will have a ripple effect on Louisiana and Baton Rouge in particular? Thank you, sir.
Yes, I do. We're waiting for that decision. So actually, this is the first I've heard of it, and the decision on stop and frisk. It will have a ripple effect in a lot of cities in the United States. Police departments were actually waiting for this decision. You know, my own personal view is that I think that there's some value to stop and frisk. They used it to tremendous effect in New York City. And I would point out again that that the communities that benefit the most from the reductions in crime are, in fact, black communities followed by Hispanic communities.
Do you like the Stand Your Ground law?
No.
Why not?
You know, what happened in the Zimmerman case... My fear is that such laws encourage people to take the law into their own hands with disastrous consequences. You know, I understand this is a hot-button issue, but there are some things that better best handled by the police. And the problem with Stand Your Ground law is that sometimes people can shoot without asking first or calling the proper authorities. Police need help, but police don't need more firepower on their side.
In our previous segment, you referred to these young people, primarily young men, floaters, who are products, as you say, of teen births, babies having babies. And there was a dramatic increase in this happening in the mid to late 80s, and these young people are now of age. Where are they now? Some of them, of course, as you state, have... been involved in violent crime. I'm sure some of them turned out fine. But if we had this great influx of these kinds of people, where are they today?
Right. I certainly don't mean to suggest that everyone who is a product of you know, a teen birth is going to go out and is compelled to a life of crime. I simply mean to point out that they're vulnerable. They're vulnerable to a lot of social problems. And where are they now? Well, obviously not are all engaged in crime, but those who are in our inner cities, and they're really not connected to anything. And we essentially have no control over them, which is why I like the work of groups like 100 Black Men, who try to find such individuals one by one on a person-by-person basis and try to pull them back into conformity.
Ed Shahada, who has been speaking about this subject for quite some time, he was part of a forum that WRKF sponsored a few years ago. I remember the Carver Library, mm-hmm. and you say violent crime, murders, down 35% in this city for this year. Now, If we come back in 6 months, do you think you'll be able to state that they were down 35% for the whole year, or is this a fluke?
You know, I have large planks of wood around me all the time. I'm knocking on wood all the time. I'm going to stick my neck out today. I'm going to stick my neck out today and say that I hope that we're going to end the year around or maybe even below 50 murders, which beats 67 any day of the, you know, any day of the year, any time.
Well, that would be a substantial decrease.
Huge drop. And it would take us off of the top five. Would probably still keep us in the top 30, which is not great, but it's better than top two or top five. Mm-hmm. You want to get off the bad list. That's the trick here.
Well, Ed Shahada, who came to LSU from Penn State, right?
Indeed.
Got your PhD at Happy Valley and fine university that had its share of controversy last year.
Oh,
but you've stayed at LSU through some difficult times. Difficult times for the university in addition for the community. Why? Why have you stayed?
You know, I've had opportunities to leave. I got an offer from Ohio State. I got an offer from Penn State to go back. I got an offer from the University of Iowa and from Kentucky and Arizona. I like LSU a great deal. It's a great school. They've always supported me. They've given me everything I've needed. And frankly, I did a lot of growing up in Alberta, in Canada, in the prairies, in the snow. I would not cry a tear if I didn't see another flake of snow in my life. So that's number one. Number two, you know, I've seen the prairies. I've seen, you know, the Midwest, all of that. Yeah. Been there, done that. I just love it down here, and I love the people, and I love the culture.
Well, we're glad you're here, and let's have you back again soon for a progress report. But
my pleasure.
Appreciate what you're doing in the community and at LSU. Dr. Ed Shahada, the chair of the sociology department. How many are in your department?
We have, we're going to be 15 very soon and growing.
Well, good luck.
Thank you,
sir. Take care. And we're joined now by Karen Carter Peterson, the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Good morning, Senator Peterson. I think we have Senator Peterson, J.C. Karen, can you hear me? Let's see if we can make contact with the senator. And I tell you what, I think we have.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good to hear your voice, your distinctive voice. How are things with the Democratic Party right now?
Things are going great. We are powered up here in Louisiana, working very, very hard with a short-term goal of taking back the Congressional District number 5 and, of course, focusing on reelecting Senator Mary Landrieu. Then we're going to use that momentum to win back the governor's office in 2015 and make some serious gains in the legislature and other down-ballot races. So I feel good about the party, where we're going. We're unified like never before, and I think a lot of that is due, Jim, to what we've seen, what I would call reckless overreach by Governor Jindal and the Louisiana Republicans. So excited.
Let's start with Congressional District number 5. Rodney Alexander, who was elected as a Democrat, has a sizable Democratic majority in his district. Now, in Louisiana, we know quite often Democrats vote the other way, but why do you think that district is fertile for a Democrat taking over a seat that's been Republican now for a decade or so?
Yeah, well, I think you hit it on the head when you said that former congressman, well, he's still the congressman now, Congressman Alexander was elected as a Democrat before he switched parties. And so he's remained in that seat for the last 10 years, as you mentioned, a decade. But this is certainly a winnable district for the right Democrat. And we believe that at the end of the day, first of all, we've got a deep bench and a lot of good Democratic elected officials that are taking a hard look at that race. Of course, qualifying is next week. And we really think it's winnable. Special elections typically are decided on turnout, and that's to our advantage as Democrats because our base is much more motivated and engaged than the other side. At the end of the day, we think that Democrats are, going to rally behind hopefully one candidate, and so we can turn this seat blue once again. It's clear that the Republicans are going to have multiple candidates on the ballot, and that's going to weaken their chances. But we believe that, you know, voters are looking for something, something different. They're really frustrated by the policies of the Republicans, like Governor Jindal, Senator Bitter, and Bill Cassidy, and they want something different. You know, when you take money away, and when the governor vetoes funding for domestic violence programs and services that help people with disabilities, and he continues to decimate higher education, we feel like we have a base that's really excited, and we can work to have a significant turnout in a special election.
All right, but on a federal level, we're talking about actions of Governor Jindal. What are the issues involving the federal race that would be in play in the 5th District next year, or actually this year for the special election, and
sure,
next year when it's done all over again?
Sure. Well, you know, you really can't bifurcate the issues too much. I mean, the kinds of things that a congressional member is fighting for is the future, obviously the progress and the future of Louisiana middle-class families, in my opinion. There are a lot of farmers up there and a lot of rural communities, in addition to two, you know, pretty central urban communities of Monroe and Alexandria. But at the end of the day, we're all fighting for the same things. And what I think the folks in that district, like any other, would want is somebody who's willing to work across party lines to get things done for families in Louisiana. I believe that you can't ignore the leadership in the Republican Party, where you have a Republican governor that Republican congressmen and senators are aligned with, right? And so, look, the top contender at this point, Senator Neil Reiser, has been a rubber stamp and a puppet of Governor Jindal. That can't be ignored. I think the best way to gauge what a person will do is to look at their record. And if you look at Senator Reiser's record, it's been just a rubber stamp to the failed and flawed policies of the Republican leadership.
He's one of your colleagues.
He's absolutely one of my colleagues. Look, a nice guy. But if you look at the policies that he supported, once again, the most recent to not suggest that we go into a veto session to override, you know, these vetoes for funding domestic violence programs and services that help people with disabilities is a serious issue that needs to be responded to. So that's what you're going to do if you go to Washington? I don't think that's what the people in the 5th District want.
Before we get to Senator Landrieu and her race, one of your colleagues, Elbert Guillory, he recently went to the other side and became a Republican. Were you surprised at all?
No, you know, I think he's probably where he wanted to be long ago. And in fact, he was there, as you know. He was a member of the Republican State Central Committee. He was an active Republican before he ran for office in, I believe it was 2007. Look, we've got, I don't want to be focused on what the other side is doing and what Elbert Guillory is doing or any other folks. We're focused on what we're doing. And I feel like the Louisiana Republican Party is desperate to distract from the failed policies of Bobby Jindal, David Bitter, and Bill Cassidy. And so they use folks like Elbert Guillory to try to distract us from the issues. I'm not going to permit mm-hmm. that to happen. I'm not going to play their game. The things that we're focusing on is, you know, providing for a good public education system, a good public health care system, a, you know, safe environment for our children and our families to grow up in, and job opportunities, economic opportunities, so that families can sustain themselves. I'm excited. What we've got, a big event coming up this Saturday. I don't know if you permit me to just a second
Certainly.
To talk about it. The Jefferson Jackson Dinner is our major event of the year. Last year we had Governor Martin O'Malley and hopefully future Senator Cory Booker, who are our speakers. And it was a wonderful event. We had over 1,000 people. This year we've got Governor Charlie Crist, who's a former governor of Florida and could be the next governor of Florida, running as a Democrat. And I think he has a great message for Louisiana and Southern Democrats. He's always been, first and foremost, a pragmatic populist, and I'm really excited. This is his first JJ, what we call JJ Jefferson Jackson dinner, that he's ever done, and we're excited to have him down here in Louisiana. We're seizing this moment because we're investing in a strong party infrastructure that we believe will help candidates up and down the ballot. And so this is our big fundraising event, and I encourage folks to to check us out and go to LouisianaDemocrats.org on the web and buy tickets and join us at the Hilton in New Orleans this Saturday night.
7 o'clock,
yep.
August 17th. Charlie Crist, the former governor of Florida, will be the keynoter at the Jefferson Jackson dinner. You mentioned Bill Cassidy a few times. He's another of your former colleagues. Obviously, you're mentioning him for a reason. He looks like he, at this point, is the major opponent for Senator Landrieu.
Yeah, you know, he's given it a good shot, I suppose, but I don't think I know, in fact, that he's not going to be successful, and the reason why is that Senator Mary Landrieu, without question, has bipartisan support because she's fought every day and every night for Louisiana values, and that's what she does up in Washington in the U.S. Senate. She's been leading our delegation on issues like fixing the flood insurance issues and making sure that that's reformed so that flood insurance can be affordable and sustainable for all those along the coast. She's fighting to make sure that we get our fair share of offshore drilling revenue so we can fund coastal restoration projects and protect our Louisiana's unique heritage and culture and way of life. She has worked with local organizations to lead the battle to save Fort Polk from huge troop reductions despite an increasingly tight military budget. And Senator Landrieu, every time she runs, Jim, she's counted out by the Republicans every cycle. And guess what happens every cycle? She comes out on top because Louisiana citizens and voters recognize what she does across party lines. And I think that that's once again going to happen next fall. She stood up to protect the most vulnerable citizens of our state and delivered funding. A lot of folks talk about government should spend less. You know, she's not, she's one that's fiscally responsible and recommending where dollars should be invested. Are we suggesting we shouldn't have a farm bill that funds and supports our farmers? Of course not. We should continue, as she has done, to get funding for rural education in many of our impoverished areas. So we need dollars coming back into our state. We call that a return on the investment, the tax dollars that we send up to Washington. So, you know, proud of what she's done. Lastly, I'd mentioned the homeless veterans in Louisiana. She's been able to get significant dollars to house homeless veterans, and she's also gotten tax credits for businesses that will hire our unemployed veterans, which we have a lot of. So, really proud of the work that she's done, and that's really one of our top priorities in the next year and a half.
297-5633 is your number outside the area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. We're visiting with State Senator Karen Carter Peterson of New Orleans, the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. 2014 shapes up as a significant year in Louisiana politics with U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu, the last Democrat standing as far as a statewide office holder, seeking a fourth term so far against the challenge of two Republicans, Congressman Bill Cassidy of Baton Rouge and Colonel Rob Manus. We'll talk more with Karen Carter Peterson after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Senator Karen Carter Peterson with us for just a bit longer. 297-5633 is your number. Senator Peterson is the chair of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Eileen in Shreveport. Good morning, Eileen. You're on the air with Senator Peterson.
Hi, good morning. Hello, Senator Peterson.
Good morning, Eileen.
Good morning. We have quite a few progressive groups in Shreveport and Northwest Louisiana. How can these groups unify to help the state Democratic Party?
Well, I'll tell you, Eileen, like right now, and certainly there are phenomenal men and women and a lot of young people. Of course, there are men and women, too, but there are a lot of folks that are doing great things up in Northwest Louisiana. I'll tell you, right now, what we need most is that energy to shift and transfer some of that over to the northeastern part of the state, so that we can have a big win in the next 10 weeks. The opportunity to elect a congressman, once again, that's a Democrat, that represents those progressive views, and we'll stand up for Louisiana middle class families with job opportunities, and protecting public education and the public health system is the number one priority in the next few months. And so if we can move some of that energy over to Northeast and get folks to, number one, focus on voter registration before the September 18th, 19th deadline for that election cycle, that would be important. The other thing I would say is voter education, making sure that people understand exactly what Louisiana Democrats stand for. And there's a big difference in the kinds of things that we will fight for. And I know that those organizations are already willing, but in working toward that goal, but to get more people involved and engaged in them. So going to the church communities, reaching out to fraternities and sororities and other social clubs, and finding people, getting people registered, but also encouraging them to grow the numbers and grow the troops so that we'll be ready not only for assistance in other areas, but when something comes up in the Northwest, and when Senator Landrieu runs next fall, we'll be ready. So,
all right, here's a question from David. He says, today's advocate reports that Congressman Cassidy's solution to health care includes health savings accounts. How does this compare with Obamacare in terms of helping people who do not have medical insurance?
Yeah, you know, Congressman Cassidy sometimes is in denial. You would think that since he's a doctor that he would understand the value of the Affordable Care Act. But it's interesting, having served for so many years an underserved and impoverished population and being the beneficiary of Medicaid dollars, you would think that he would really understand and appreciate the value of the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act. To be against Medicaid expansion is nonsensical for some of the area that he currently represents, and certainly in this state. There are close to 400,000 people that would be covered if, in fact, this state were to accept Medicaid expansion. Congressman Cassidy has the ability right now to stand up and show leadership and push Governor Jindal to do what's right for Louisiana families. If you were to poll that, and guess what, Jim? Somebody's already done it. Poll Louisiana citizens, and they say, should Louisiana turn down 100% of federal support to insure people and to, in fact, save lives? Overwhelmingly, over a majority of people would say yes, and they have. And so if you want me to specifically answer to the nuance in the alternative strategy that Congressman Cassidy has pulled out of a hat in health savings accounts, I would suggest to you that I'm not opposed to health savings accounts. I think there's great benefit associated with it, but I think Congressman Cassidy is trying to divert attention from what he's going to have to answer for, and that is Senator Mary Landrieu's strong support of the Affordable Care Act, because it's taking care of people, making sure that folks that have pre-existing conditions can be insured. It's taking care of young people at the age of 26 to be able to stay on their parents' insurance. It's taking care of a lot of needy people, and it was a good decision, and he is trying to run away from the fact that he's not trying to take care of, with a specific policy and federal funding that he had the ability to support, he walked away from 400,000 people. And that's embarrassing, and he needs to be held accountable for that, and I think he will next fall.
Do you stand firm, Senator, in your opposition to the governor not accepting the Medicaid expansion?
I could not stand firmer. These are lives. These are real lives. It's not just some policy decision being made on the fourth floor. I'm very, very firm in my belief, along with Senator Landrieu, that this was an opportunity for Louisiana to help thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. There are Republican governors all across this country that put their political agenda aside to stand up for the people of their state, namely Jan Brewer of Arizona, namely Chris Christie of New Jersey, namely Rick Scott of Florida. These folks said, you know what, I'm going to put Floridians, New Jerseyans, Arizonans first. But Governor Jindal did not put Louisiana first, and Bill Cassidy is following right along that path. That's not what we need in Washington, certainly not in the U.S. Senate. And so I think Louisiana families are going to be very clear and educated when they go to the polls next fall and know the clear choice that they're making. And once again, just like in the case of Senator Neil Reiser, you know, your record, Congressman Cassidy's record, will be enough evidence as to why he should not be promoted to the U.S. Senate.
Here's a question from Emily. What went wrong with Senate Democrats on the veto override session? House Democrats were ready to go, writes Emily. What happened with the Senate?
Yeah, and so I think that I'm really proud of all of the House Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Democrats, and Senate Republicans, which were a majority, Jim. There were over 80 folks that voted to support a veto session, but as you know, it wasn't in both houses. And so every individual legislator needs to be held accountable for what they do. And, you know, as a senator, in addition to being party chair, as a senator, I had to vote on behalf of what my constituents wanted. And I think that, you know, funding for domestic violence victims and funding for people with disabilities was important enough to go back to Baton Rouge and protect that. That's how I voted. Everybody, every individual senator that voted another way will be held accountable at the appropriate time in election season.
But as chair of the Democratic Party, though, do you ever go to your fellow Democrats and say, this is one you need to take for the team?
Oh, there's no question that I encourage and I lobby and I suggest to them that with respect to our democratic principles, this is what I believe, you know, our party stands for. But once again, I have to permit people to make their own decisions on behalf of their constituencies. I would encourage you to invite some of the folks on and ask them why. Why did they not support the veto session? Because I can't answer for every individual. I'll tell you this. There are many advocates all across this state that I work tirelessly with, and I'm hopeful at this point, since it did not occur, that some of those same Republicans and Democrats in the Senate, because the Senate did not vote to do it, of course, that they will try to identify funding in the interim through BA7s and interim financing to try to make this work. I don't know how it can happen, but, you know, this is the – I didn't vote for the budget, by the way. This was a horrible budget.
You were, weren't you the lone dissenter at the end?
Yes, and I slept well that night. Very well.
Here's a question, and we will take a few more calls in our remaining moments with Karen Carter-Peterson. But a question from Michelle. Do you support, Senator, the move by a levy board in your area to sue oil companies for ripping up the coast? Do you think that was a good move?
Yeah, you know, I think that we've got a coastline that has been damaged for decades. And, you know, it is important for that full responsibility be taken by oil companies and any other entities that had a part in damaging our coast. Certainly, Senator Landrieu is fighting to get the returns that we should get for the kinds of investments that we make at the federal level. But, you know, I think it'll shake itself out, and we'll see what happens with the lawsuit. It's interesting. I haven't read it in its entirety, I'll be honest with you. But certainly there's some good points being made, and I don't think that there are arguments as to contributions to the decimation, quite honestly, of our coast. And so it's important that we fight to protect our coast. Or guess what? I'm in New Orleans. We won't be here in a couple of decades at the rate the coast is eroding. And so we've got to make sure that we encourage folks to take to put the necessary protections in and to rebuild it. And that's going to take money. And there may be some folks that owe us something as a result of that.
Betty in City Park. Betty, you're on the air with Senator Peterson.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you, Senator Peterson, for all the fighting that you do for the
state.
I just had a concern that may be totally off of what you're talking about now. But I've just had some concerns about the different Democrats that were Democrats when elected but jumped ship midway through the, through it. And is that right? Can they do that?
Yeah, well, so thanks for the call, and certainly thanks for the compliment. I enjoy what I do, and I'm fighting hard to protect this state in its interest. You know, it's everybody's right to be aligned with any, you know, and have a different party affiliation. The problem is it's totally disingenuous, in my opinion, and I think you might agree based on your comments, to change parties after having been elected as an affiliate of another party. So, for example, if this would be my opinion, if you're going to change parties, I would think that the best time to do that would be in the election cycle, so people know exactly who you are, who you're affiliated with, and what those values are affiliated with, you know, the party. So, but you can't, you know, the only way to hold folks accountable is for the electorate to do that. And so we can use the examples of some recent elected officials that have switched parties. And, you know, election cycle is coming up again in 2015, and only the people can hold them accountable because it is their right, it's legal, it probably is distasteful to many. And so that's all I could probably recommend is that the electorate step up and respond to the elected officials that are doing that.
You noted that Mary Landrieu has been counted out, and you're right, all three times by various pundits, and she's won close races in succession against Woody Jenkins, Susie Terrell, and John Kennedy.
Sure.
Now, she's won three times as a U.S. Senator. David Vitter's won twice in 2004 and in 2010, and in both times he won by significantly more convincing margins than Senator Landrieu has. How do you explain that?
Look, I think that Mary, and I shouldn't be saying Mary, Senator Landrieu, because she is fighting for Louisiana values and she is not voting in a way that's aligned even with President Obama or the Republican Party. She votes and puts Louisiana first. She looks at it, and just as I referenced Governor Charlie Crist as a pragmatic populist, I would say the same about Senator Landrieu. They have that in common. I think that at the end of the day, folks are going to understand what she's fought for and her value moving forward. You may not know, and I'm not sure if you've announced, this has been publicly really widely spread, that the current chairman of the Energy Committee is not running for reelection. Therefore, Senator Landrieu, when she's reelected, will be chair of the Senate Energy Committee. That's significant,
That's if Democrats retain a majority in the Senate, and if Landrieu,
and we'll do that too. That's just a given. Jim, look. We're going to take care of our business here in Louisiana, and trust me, the Democrats all across this country are working very hard to make sure we maintain that majority because it really does matter. I mean, you can see from the policies that are instituted that it makes a huge difference.
Well, you made a good point about why people vote for Mary Landrieu, and I'm sure that many who vote conservatively otherwise vote for her, as was proved in the election in 2008 when she won going away against John Kennedy with 53% on the same day that President Obama got 39% in Louisiana. So she's popular in ways that other Democrats are not. But what about Senator Vitter? How does he remain popular? How does he get reelected in a landslide? How did that happen 3 years ago?
Look, I can't explain that. I tell you what, I've only been chair for the last year, so... I don't understand why folks haven't paid close attention to Senator Vitter's record and how he, along with Governor Jindal and Congressman Cassidy, have been very destructive in their failed policies. I think that, you know, first of all, I'm not focusing on Senator Vitter right now and what the other side is doing. We're focused on what we're doing, and that's powering up Democrats to win the Congressional District 5. And to make sure that Mary Landrieu gets reelected.
But he's involved in that race, though. His whole campaign apparatus is now surrounding Congressman Cassidy at the congressman's behest. So it's definitely a case in which David Vitter is doing everything he can to unseat his fellow New Orleanian Mary Landrieu.
Yeah, well, Senator Landrieu is certainly going to work and put in significant time and, you know, be in overdrive to make sure that we recapture Congressional District 5. So similarly on the other side. But I cannot be focused, and I will not be diverted in my energy and enthusiasm from what we got going on our side. I'm not going to focus on David Vitter. I'm going to focus on an agenda that will move Louisiana forward and that's in the best interest of all Louisiana citizens and encourage the close to 1.4 Democrats to vote Democratic in this state once again. There are only about 800,000 and maybe Republicans and 700,000 registered independents.
We got a roll, Senator, but 1.4 million Democrats in the state, and she is the head of the Democratic Party. Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Thanks. My pleasure. Let's do it again. And for J.C. Cain, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.